Coming close to the end now of our series of studies in the book of Micah. Today we're going to look at just the first half of Micah chapter 6. Micah chapter 6, and I'm reading from verses 1 to 8. Listen to what the Lord says. Stand up. Plead your case before the mountains. Let the hills hear what you have to say. Hear, O mountains, the Lord's accusation. Listen, you everlasting foundations of the earth. For the Lord has a case against his people. He is lodging a charge against Israel. My people, what have I done to you? How have I burdened you? Answer me. I brought you up out of Egypt and redeemed you from the land of slavery. I sent Moses to lead you, also Aaron and Miriam. My people, remember what Balak, king of Moab, counseled and what Balaam, son of Beor, answered. Remember your journey from Shittim to Gilgal, that you may know the righteous acts of the Lord. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has showed you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. I rather like the apparently true story of the sixth former who came up to Cambridge to attend an interview for a place to study philosophy. One of the learned professors on the interview panel unfortunately suffered from a bad lisp. So when he asked the nervous student if he knew anything about ethics, he received the unexpected reply, "Not much, sir, but I do have an aunt who lives in Colchester." Even with no lisp to cause misunderstanding in philosophical debate, ethics are in a highly confused state today, aren't they? There's a much acclaimed book entitled After Virtue by the American philosopher Alasdair MacIntyre. And he goes so far in that book as to claim that our contemporary world has really lost its comprehension of morality. Though we continue to use ethical language, he says, we've lost the philosophical context which gave that language significance. So a word like justice, he says, has no agreed meaning any longer. Moral values are the cultural equivalent of a vestigial organ, which social evolution has rendered obsolete and redundant. In fact, he makes the case at length in that book that what he calls the Enlightenment Project has failed. In the last 400 years, he says, philosophers have tried to build a system of ethics based entirely on human reason. The utilitarians were the most famous, of course, trying to deduce the meaning of the word right and wrong purely from considerations of social expediency. An action is right, they said, if it results in the greatest happiness of the greatest number. But, says MacIntyre, that approach just hasn't worked. All such attempts to rationalize morality have failed, with the result that we don't have a philosophical basis for ethics anymore. Though we toss moral judgments around, it's all just empty rhetoric. There is no moral consensus any longer. We do not agree what we mean by right and wrong, and even more importantly, we don't have any way to debate our differences on the issue. All we have, he says, are private opinions about moral questions. Opinions which we can revise at will. Opinions which we can disregard with impunity. And opinions which consequently have very little social cogency or influence. I have to say McIntyre is right in his analysis. Western culture committed a suicidal blunder when it abandoned its biblical and Christian heritage and tried to secularize the field of human knowledge, to build philosophy without a Bible. Because, you see, as confidence in reason and science has declined in our century, so ethical values have become less and less secure. And the result is that now, as McIntyre suggests, we are in a perilously maladaptive state. Moral values have been so eroded by relativism that some quite wise cultural analysts fear that the very stability of Western civilization may have been lethally undermined. Book after book has appeared in the last few years, urging us to try to turn the cultural clock back in some way. David Selborne wrote a book a few years back, calling us to reaffirm the importance of old-fashioned civic virtues over against individual rights. The chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, has similarly written a book cautioning us about the danger of rampant individualism and calling us back to traditional family values. Nicholas Tate, the head of the school's inspectorate, has urged that education should once again see its role as a transmitter of moral values rather than just a skill of skills and information. And of course, all these warnings have been given rather poignant force by escalating statistics of family breakdown and criminality among the young and so forth, which the newspapers have never ceased but to parade before our eyes. Sadly, though, in spite of the fact there is considerable public awareness and I think even public concern about the decay of moral values in our day, one looks in vain for any convincing solution to the problem. For of course, as McIntyre says in his book, the simple fact is, it is not possible to construct a cogent system of ethics without some acknowledgement of moral authority over human life. Morality requires the use of the imperative. You know what imperatives are? Orders. Everybody who knows anything about language at all knows that imperatives can't be expressed in the first person singular. Imperatives are always expressed in the second person. No matter how clever a philosopher you are, you can't turn the "I think" of private moral opinion into the "thou shalt" of a universal moral obligation. It just can't be done. So secular ethics, for this reason, are bound to end up in a state of uncertainty and confusion. The Enlightenment project, as McIntyre calls it, was bound to fail. The seeds of its failure were sown right there, the very moment that European philosophy espoused the ambition to ground truth in human reason rather than biblical revelation. Roger Scruton, another philosopher, has just published a book entitled An Intelligent Person's Guide to Modern Culture. And in part of it, he makes, I think, this very point. He comes to the extraordinary conclusion that it's necessary to live as if religion were true, even though he admits for him personally, religion is now unbelievable. In a rather telling sentence in his book, he observes, "Consolation drawn from imaginary things is not imaginary consolation." Which reminds me of Voltaire's famous dictum that if God didn't exist, it would be necessary to invent him. Roger Scruton seems to believe that's precisely our current situation. Though he's a self-confessed unbeliever, he plays the organ in his local church. Because only by upholding such religious traditions can the moral fabric of society be kept intact. The intellectual incoherence of such a position would be comic, I think, if it didn't carry such tragic consequences for the future of modern culture. One recalls Woody Allen's rather cynical comment. "Civilization stands at the crossroads," he says. "Down one road is despondency and despair, and down the other is total annihilation. Let us pray we choose the right road." Well, I think he's right. There can be no long-term future for a society that's lost confidence in moral imperatives. They're indispensable for social existence. And it's for that reason, I think, that this passage in Micah is so relevant to our modern world, because Micah believes moral imperatives exist. More than that, he knows how we lost them and how we may rediscover them. Look again at that magisterial final verse, verse 8. He has showed you, O man, what is good. What does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with your God. Those of you who've been following this series from the 11 o'clock service will know that Micah is addressing the people of Judah in the 8th century BC. We've seen in some earlier weeks that the nation stands, as he writes, on the very threshold of judgment. In fact, the Assyrian invader may well have already swept through the land and be besieging the capital city of Jerusalem even as Micah speaks these words. The Micah has told the Jewish people that this disaster has come upon them as a direct result of their abandonment of God and of his moral law. In particular, he has complained back in chapter 2 and again in chapter 5 of the economic injustice and the oppression that's being perpetrated within their community by rich and powerful people. Well, now in this chapter, chapter 6, he's using the form of a judicial hearing in court. He imagines God invoking the ancient mountains to act as a kind of jury, while he, like an injured plaintiff, lays his charge before his people. Let the hills hear what you have to say. Hear, O mountains, the Lord's accusation. For the Lord has a case against his people. He is lodging a charge against Israel. You notice in verses 3 to 5, he goes on in rather wounded tones. Remind them of the many generous things he had done for them in the past, the righteous acts, as he calls them in verse 5, which he performed on their behalf, particularly in the deliverance from Egypt and the journey to the promised land that followed that remarkable exodus. Have I been such a burden to you? He asks, with heavy irony. Have I injured you in some way? Have I wearied you? That you should have treated me and my law with such contempt and neglect? And then in verses 6 to 7, at the end of this indignant indictment, you'll notice suddenly the subject of the verbs changes. From verse 6 on, it's no longer God who's speaking, but the prophet himself. In fact, in a clever piece of dramatic dialogue, Micah in verse 6 is assuming the imagined role of an inquiring listener. A listener who has been touched by God's accusation, by this interrogation at the bar of justice by God. This listener wants to know how he should deal with the guilt feelings that have been awoken in him as a result of all this. How can I make amends for the offense I've done to God, he asks. What must I do to be accepted once again in God's presence? Religion offers so many different kinds of atoning rituals. Which is the effective one? With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings? With thousands of rams? And it is in reply to that rhetorical question that the prophet makes the stunning affirmation, which, as I say, forms the climax of our study passage in verse 8. Micah's hypothetical inquirer does not have to speculate about the appropriate response to God's moral rebuke, because what God requires of any penitent is not sacramental rituals, no matter how costly, says Micah, but a new personal commitment to moral obedience. He has showed you, O man, what is good. What does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. In its most immediate context, then, those words are addressed to a representative Jew from Micah's own community in 8th century Jerusalem. But it would be a great mistake, I think, to limit the application of Micah's words as a result of that limited historical context. Micah, I am sure, is very consciously embracing a much wider audience than just his own people here in verse 8. In fact, I think he uses that expression, O man, in the first line of verse 8, rather than, O Israel, as you might have expected, precisely because he wants to include in what he's saying here the whole of the human race. Of course, Jewish people did have a distinct privilege. They had access to the revelation of the Bible. In the law of Moses, God had showed them in a very special way what he meant by the word good. He was known to the Jews not just by the general name El, which all Semitic peoples of the ancient Middle East used when they spoke of God. God was known by the Jews also by the unique covenantal name, Jehovah, the Lord, as it's translated here. But Micah didn't believe that this privilege meant that the Jews held a monopoly on moral and spiritual knowledge. On the contrary, for someone as outspokenly opposed to pagan idolatry as Micah was, Micah displays an unexpectedly bold universalism in this book. As again, those of you who've been following this series will remember. A couple of weeks ago, we saw very startling evidence of it in chapter 4, where in a magnificent vision of the future kingdom of God, Micah predicts that all the nations, not just Israel, but all the nations, will be brought into an era of global peace. And he concludes that vision with the remarkable affirmation, all the peoples will walk in the name of their gods, and we will walk in the name of our God forever and ever. Seems, you see, that the feature of idolatry that was offensive to prophets like Micah was not that pagans addressed God by the wrong name. What was offensive about idolatry was that human beings, in their arrogance, thought they could make God any way they wanted him to be and manipulate him to do whatever they wanted him to do. That was the essence of idolatry. What matters is not what we call God, but how we imagine God to be. And as such, of course, idolatry was every bit as much a danger for the biblically informed Jew as it was for the biblically illiterate pagan. That's why Micah, I think, has both in mind here in verses 6 to 8. In fact, if I was to fully declare my mind on this text, I'd have to offer you an interpretation of it, which you will find in no commentary, and which you may therefore wish to exercise some caution about as a result. I think, you know, when Micah uses these rhetorical questions in verses 6 and 7, I think he's assuming the role not just of one spiritually responsive inquirer, but two. The first inquirer he has in mind is a spiritually responsive Jew, and the second is a spiritually responsive pagan. That, I think, illumines that the oscillating poetic parallels that you'll find in his words. He asks, you see, in verse 6, with what shall I come before Jehovah, the Lord? That's the way a Jew would ask the question. But then he goes on in the parallel, with what shall I bow down to Elohim, the exalted God? Which is the way a pagan might well put it. Then the Jewish inquirer returns in verse 7, suggesting, you see, the kind of cultic remedies for sin that he was familiar with from the Bible. Burnt offerings, year-old calves, rams, holy oil, and the like. His pagan equivalent, however, without the Bible to assist him, wonders instead, rather superstitiously, whether human sacrifice, such as was associated with the worship of Moloch in the ancient world, might suffice to make atonement for his sin. Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, he asks, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? The prophet's answer, as we've already observed in both cases, is negative. To the representative pagan, he says, with appropriately universal vocabulary, he has shown you, O man, what is good. Then turning to the representative Jew, he says with similar appropriateness, and what does Jehovah, what does the Lord require of you? And once again, the answer in both cases is significantly identical. It consists of three simple moral imperatives: to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. I don't believe that text is meant to be read only against its narrow background in ancient Judah. That's an affirmation of the universal moral and spiritual obligation of the entire human race. Micah intends, I'm sure, us to understand it that way. It's the answer, in other words, to our initial inquiry about the nature of ethics. It's the Bible's reply to our contemporary loss of moral consensus. Micah here is telling us the answer to our problem. He tells us here then, first of all, every human being has access to moral truth. He has shown you, O man, what is good. Micah is convinced, as indeed the whole Bible is convinced, that every human being knows the difference between right and wrong. And it is in vain that we protest that we don't. That means, of course, that Christians don't have to despair about our world in the way perhaps that some secular philosophers are despairing about it. For though people may not share our Christian faith, they may nevertheless intuitively share our Christian values. That's why, of course, Christian engagement in the field of social ethics isn't a waste of time. Conservative Christians have sometimes adopted the line, well, the world's doomed. There's nothing you can do with the world except to pluck souls from the burning by urgent preaching of salvation from hell. Well, undoubtedly, evangelism is a very urgent priority for the church. God forbid I should suggest it isn't. But that doesn't mean there's no role for Christians in public life. It doesn't mean that all Christians have to do is to sit around gloomily and wait for the second coming to make it all right. No, those who are outside the community of God's people still have a sense of moral values. And no amount of postmodern skepticism is going to completely erode that moral awareness, because it is not actually a philosophical deduction based on reason, even if the philosophers think it is. That moral awareness is in fact a divine revelation written into every human heart. He has shown you, O man, what is good. So no matter how pagan or atheistic our world becomes, its conscience will always be on the side of the Bible. In fact, if you're an unbeliever this morning, then I put it to you, your conscience is on God's side. Even though maybe like Roger Scruton, you can't explain why. Every human being has access to moral truth, says Micah. And that's an encouragement. More than that, says Micah, every human being is aware of the fundamental ingredients that comprise that moral truth. What does the Lord require of you but to act justly and to love mercy? So the first two of Micah's trio of imperatives strike a balance. It's a balance, I suggest to you, which any system of ethics has to seek to honour. It's the balance between doing the right thing and doing the kind thing. The right thing and the kind thing. Morality, says Micah, is about blending justice and mercy. The Hebrew word translated justice there speaks of the need to respect and observe those principles and statutes which were enshrined in the legislation of the Bible. The word mercy, on the other hand, speaks of the generosity of heart and the faithfulness without which human relationships decay. And what God requires of us, Micah seems to be saying, is a moral concern to work both things out. To work out what is fair and right in a society, but in a way that thinks about the impact of those just decisions on people. Now, I'm reading at the moment a book, rather an expensive book, I'm afraid, but I was tempted to get it by the review I read, The Crisis of Global Capitalism by George Soros. It's rare that a book that costs me that much causes me so much grief. Soros, as some of you may know, is close to being the richest man in the world. He's made billions, and I mean billions, through speculating in the financial markets. He's now so rich that when he moves his money around, the economies of entire countries are affected. In fact, some believe it was his actions which precipitated the recent collapse in the financial markets of the Far East. A charge which, in this book, he does not deny. In fact, I get the distinct impression this book's an attempt by Soros to exculpate himself from blame for that particular economic disaster. Global capitalism, he tells us, is in crisis. But then he goes on to say, when people like me make a fortune, though the money has to come from somewhere, ultimately it has to come from other people's pockets, I am not to be blamed, he says. For it is the nature of capitalistic free markets that if I didn't make that money, somebody else would. So why shouldn't it be me? If there are undesirable social consequences, he says, from the way that free markets work, it's not up to me to restrain my activities. That just dooms me to failure. It's up to the international community to act and make rules that prevent not just me, but every other entrepreneur in the game from damaging people. Now, Soros is a very shrewd and widely read guy, and to be fair to him, he's a man who's done a great deal of philanthropic activity. His book is in many ways a scholarly book and a humane book. It makes fascinating reading. But I have to tell you, as far as economics is concerned, it's the most appallingly amoral book I have read in a long while. I found myself at one point imagining a homicidal maniac with blood dripping from his knife, pleading to the courts that it really isn't his fault there are so many corpses lying around. It's the fault of the police. They should have stopped him from doing it. Soros wants to argue, you see, that playing the financial markets in the way he does is immune from moral criticism. If I was dealing with people, he says, then of course I would have to consider morality. But thank God I'm not. I'm dealing with money, so that's all right. And if that's what he thinks, he's in for a shock when he stands before the judgment throne of God. What does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy. Morality in God's book is not just about obeying the letter of the law. It's about thinking what the consequences of your actions are in terms of fairness and in terms of human relationships. George Soros can no more wash his hands of the economic misery his financial greed has generated in some of the weaker nations of the world than Pilate could wash his hands of the blood of Christ. Whether the rules allowed him to do it or not is quite irrelevant. We are required by heaven to act justly and to love mercy. George Soros seems to feel that a financial speculator like him does not have to do either. Well, there were rather a lot of people just like him in Jerusalem in the 8th century BC. And Micah is written in part to explain why their affluence collapsed around their ears, too. And unlike George Soros, Micah does not allow those economic exploiters of the situation to go unblamed. Every human being not only has access to moral truth, every human being deep down is aware of the fundamental ingredients that comprise that moral truth. Acting justly and loving mercy. But Micah is convinced of a third thing also in his three imperatives. Not only that we know the moral truth, but that we know that moral truth is not alone enough. He has showed you, O man, what is good. What does the Lord require of you but to act justly, to love mercy, and the third imperative, to walk humbly with your God. Ironically, I think that's just this point that many of us religious people, us church people, make shipwreck, you know. It is very easy for us to turn our concern for ethics into pompous moralizing. Very easy to mistake a Pharisee for a Christian. That's what happened historically to a group called the Moral Rearmament before the war. Some of you are old enough to remember them. They finished up flirting dangerously with fascism in their zeal to re-establish moral discipline in Western society. It is, I fear, a very real danger also for the so-called moral majority in the United States at this moment. Campaigns for law and order, denunciations of presidential sexual immorality, calls for the reintroduction of capital punishment and so forth. Christians concerned about the moral state of society have always been well represented on the side of such conservative causes. To such an extent that many people think that is what the Christian religion is all about. Social ethics. Well, it isn't. Micah wants us to understand biblical religion is not about that. There are three imperatives, not just two. And the third is in many respects the most crucial, because it's upon that third imperative the other two hang. To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. The reason, Micah says, there is a moral vacuum in society is because there is a spiritual vacuum. It was because we abandoned the God of the Bible and chose to deify human reason, just as really as those ancient Jews deified Baal and Asherah. We got ourselves into this predicament of moral collapse and confusion. And if our response is to fill that vacuum with ethics, you will not get the religion of Christ, you will just get the religion of the Pharisees. Jesus did not come into the world to give us a better rule book. The rule book was already there. He didn't even come into the world to teach us the meaning of justice and mercy. For the Old Testament fully declared the meaning of those two words. Now that first Christmas, Jesus came into the world to be God with us. He came to offer us relationship with God. He came to make it possible again for us to walk humbly with our God. For without such an intimate and personal relationship, all our so-called morality is just an exercise in self-righteous posturing that will very likely simply feed our sanctimonious pride. There will be no humble walking for the Pharisee in us. Notice that the intimacy of that possessive pronoun, to walk humbly with your God. There are lots of people around, of course, who believe in God theoretically, who've heard the arguments for the existence of God, maybe even feel like Roger Scruton, belief in God is a good thing socially, and so give it a mental tick in their minds. There are plenty of people around who enjoy religious tradition, who will come to church at Christmas time and sing carols, taking on their lips all sorts of words of faith, and enjoy them, and even wish in some way to identify with that Christian tradition of their culture. There are plenty of people around who have a kind of second-hand faith, who feed off the faith of their husband or their wife or their parents, or their brother, or their sister, or their friend. But none of these, I think, know God. None of these, I think, walk with God in the intimate and personal way that Micah is describing here. Walking humbly with your God. My great anxiety is that evangelical Christianity today sometimes has a lot more in common with the Pharisees than it does with Jesus. It's more concerned about campaigning for moral issues than it is for demonstrating to people what a sweet and beautiful thing it is to walk daily with God as your companion. Learn from Micah then that the world needs more than ethics. And if you will not learn it from Micah, learn it from the baby in the manger. Let's pray together.